Far in HRI, and Mangesh is my student. Okay, I've given a list of contents of the talk. I'll start with a long introduction and background, and then turn to the topic of the talk. Okay, so today I will be talking about Chern-Simons field theories in three dimensions coupled to matter fields. Before turning to the subject, I'll give you a brief review of Chern-Simons theories in three dimensions without matter fields. Okay. So what is a Chern-Simons theory? A Chern-Simons theory is a gauge theory. It lives in three dimensions. But what makes it peculiar or unfamiliar if you've not dealt with it before is that its action, the action for the gauge field, is not the familiar Maxwell or Yang-Mills Lagrangian, but instead the strange object. There are many things about this Lagrangian that are unusual. Okay, so this could be based on any gauge group, but through my talk, the gauge group will always be UN. Okay, through much of my talk, N will be large, but not yet. Okay, so there are many things about this Lagrangian that are odd if you haven't seen it before. The first thing that's odd is that this Lagrangian does not involve only the field strength. It involves the gauge field. So this looks strange because it looks like the action is not gauge invariant. Okay, that's not completely true. Oh, well, as we'll see, it's not completely true. You see, what is true is that the action is not the integral of a gauge invariant local Lagrangian density. But the action itself is gauge invariant to the extent that it's needed to be for physics. Let me quickly tell you about that. Firstly, let's look at the easiest part of the gauge invariance. Gauge invariant under gauge transformations connected to identity. Okay, and let's study this for simplicity in the U1 theory because it's easiest to see. So in the U1 theory, the action is ADA. And under a gauge transformation, this DA doesn't change because that's field strength, that's gauge invariant, but A changes. So delta S is equal to D lambda DA. And now, if we can integrate by parts, this is gauge invariant. I mean, the delta S is zero just because D squared is here. Okay? So suppose we were on S3, so there's no barrier to integrating by parts, and you know the gauge transformation was connected to identity, this would just give us zero. Okay? A similar manipulation works for the non-abelian theory. However, not all gauge transformations are connected to identity. For instance, on S3 in the UN theory, in the SU2 theory, for example, you could have a gauge transformation in which the gauge transformation winds, is a map from S3 to S3, which winds around the S3. For such gauge transformations, this integration by parts maneuver is not strictly correct. But when you work it out, you don't get that delta S is zero, but you get that for such gauge transformations, this thing shifts by a quantized amount, proportional to the winding number of this gauge transformation. And I've chosen these normalizations such that that quantized amount is exactly 2 pi times an integer if k is an integer. Now, in physics, we don't really care about the gauge invariance of the action. We only care about the gauge invariance of e to the power is, which appears in the path integral. Okay, so provided s shifts only by 2 pi times an integer, physics is gauge invariant. Okay. So this Lagrangian describes nice gauge invariant physics, provided k is an integer. Okay? Now, that's the first odd thing about this action. It's not the integral over a local a gauge invariant local Lagrangian density, and therefore it only makes sense when the coupling constant of Chern-Simons theory is the inverse of an integer. The second thing that's interesting about this theory is its equation of motion. The equation of motion, as you can easily check for yourself, is simply that the field strength is equal to zero. Now, the field strength in a gauge theory contains all local gauge invariant data of the gauge field. So if your equation of motion tells you that the field strength is zero, it's telling you that locally, the gauge field is pure gauge. This needn't be true globally. For instance, if you were a tortoise and you had a cycle, you could have Wilson lines, which are field strength zero but are not pure gauge. But this tells you that this theory has very few degrees of freedom. There are no local degrees of freedom in this theory. All degrees of freedom are associated with some global business. Okay? So this theory here is a very simple kind of theory. In a way, you shouldn't even really call it a quantum field theory, because it doesn't have local degrees of freedom. Some people sometimes call it topological quantum field theory. Okay? Great. So pure Chern-Simons theory is a very simple kind of theory. It's so simple that it can be exactly solved and has been exactly solved and studied in great detail by many people, starting with the famous work of Witt. Excellent. Now, pure Chern-Simons theory is very nice, very totally solvable, but not of great interest for studying local physics because it has no local dynamics, no gluons in this theory. However, suppose you were to take this theory and couple it to matter fields. Okay? So suppose you studied the following theory, for example. The Chern-Simons theory plus a fermion in any representation of the gauge group, minimally coupled to the gauge field. Now this theory is a genuine quantum field theory. It has local degrees of freedom because there are local degrees of freedom in the matter. By the way, the equation of motion here gets generalized to k times f is equal to the matter contribution of the current. And this once again tells you that there's no genuine information in the gauge field. Once you know what the matter is doing, you know what the gauge field is doing up to some global stuff. Okay? But there are genuine degrees of freedom in the matter. So now we've got a real quantum field theory with local degrees of freedom. These local degrees of freedom should roughly be thought of as associated with the matter. And the Chern-Simons gauge field mediates long-range, non-local, interesting interactions for these matter fields. Okay, so why should we be interested in studying matter Chern-Simons theories? There are many reasons. One of which I'll focus on, just to get us started, has to do with scale invariance. Suppose you were interested in studying scale invariant physics in three dimensions. The Chern-Simons action is very natural for that purpose. The first reason for this is simply dimensional. The Yang-Mills action in three dimensions has a dimensionful coupling constant, whereas the Chern-Simons action has a dimensionless coupling constant. Okay? So this already immediately suggests that classical Chern-Simon physics will be much easier to can be made scale invariant very easily. Yang-Mills cannot be, just because it has a dimension. Okay, but you know, this is very similar to Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions. In four dimensions, the Yang-Mills theory has a classically dimensionless coupling constant. But as all of us know, quantum mechanically, it's pretty hard to make Yang-Mills theory scale invariant. You have to work to do that in four dimensions. The situation is actually much better for Chern-Simons theories. The thing that makes it difficult to make Yang-Mills theory scale invariant in four dimensions is the beta function for the gauge group. Okay? Now, the beta function for Chern-Simons coupling is necessarily zero. This follows simply because the inverse of an integer cannot continuously run. Okay? So it's very easy to make theories that are scale invariant, both classically as well as quantum mechanically, in three dimensions, without supersymmetry. Okay, the word supersymmetry is not going to enter my talk today after the sentence. Unless, okay, yes, okay. Without supersymmetry, it's very easy to manufacture conformal field theories in three dimensions using Chern-Simons theories. Okay, let me give you once again this example. Suppose we took this theory of the minimally coupled scalar field with this Chern-Simons action. The only marginal or relevant operator in this theory, okay, at least at weak enough coupling, the only marginal or relevant operator in this theory is the mass term for the fermions. The term that is psi bar psi to the 4 is dimension 4, which is irrelevant in three dimensions. So the only thing that could spoil scale invariance is turning on a mass term, but mass terms are easily tuned away. For instance, if you wrote down this theory, set the mass to zero and worked in dimensional regularization, the mass will never be generated. And that defines a conformal field theory. Okay? Quantum mechanically, exactly conformal. Just these words are sufficient to
to guarantee that this theory is scale invariant. Okay? Compare this with the difficulty of creating conformal field theories in four dimensions. Okay, so this is one reason to study Chern-Simons theories in three dimensions. It's very easy to make scale invariant theories using Chern-Simons theories. Okay, now in my talk, I'm going to be studying this theory. We're going to come to other reasons to study it. Let me immediately say one of the other reasons. One of the other reasons is this. You see, this theory here was a collection of scale invariant points labeled by two integers n and k. However, there's an interesting large n limit of these theories that parallels the Toft limit, which is the limit in which n goes to infinity, k goes to infinity, but n by k, which is called lambda, is kept fixed. Okay, actually, for reasons we will come to in a little bit, I'll often find it convenient to define lambda as n divided by k plus n. This k plus n is sometimes called kappa in the Chern-Simons literature. So n divided by kappa is kept fixed. In this limit, this is the effective loop counting parameter of the theory, the thing that weights two loop versus one loop graphs. And this number, this thing becomes effectively continuous because in this limit, the points accumulate. So in the large n limit, we get effectively a line of fixed points. Okay? That also makes it interesting because we've got used to the fact that when we've got a line of fixed points that interpolates from weak coupling to strong coupling, something interesting can happen at strong coupling. Really interesting stuff is like creating gravity, like in n equals 4 Yang-Mills or ABJM theory. But generically, if you've got a line of fixed points with a strong coupling end, it's a good idea to ask what happens at strong coupling. Okay? That's another reason to study these theories. You get not just conformal fixed points, but effectively in large n limits, conformal fixed lines. Okay. A third reason to study them is because of what happens in these theories, as I will soon review. But before going there, I want to introduce another set of of Chern-Simons matter theories that are easily made conformal. Okay? And these Chern-Simons matter theories are theories in which the Chern-Simons gauge field is interacting not with a fermionic degree of freedom, but a scalar degree of freedom. Okay, so these theories are a little hard, are a little more complicated, so you'll have to bear with me a bit. So the theory I've got is this Chern-Simons action plus the kinetic term for the scalar, plus the mass term for the scalar, plus a phi to the 4 interaction for the scalar. At the moment, this is far from conformal. Okay, the mass scale isn't the problem. There's MB and B4, both massive parameters. Now, this Lagrangian can be rewritten by adding an additional field sigma and adding a term in the action for sigma so that if you integrate out sigma, you just go back to the original Lagrangian. The additional term I've chosen is written in green here. Okay? Clearly, if you integrate sigma out, just set sigma equal to this. There's some trivial measure factor, and you go back to your original theory. But I've chosen this green term cleverly so that this term and this term are canceled when you add this and this. So the full theory, including the sigma field, takes the form kinetic term plus sigma phi bar phi plus these two other terms. A term which is linear in sigma and a term that's quadratic in sigma. Now, on this theory, there is an interesting limit one can take. The interesting limit is to take the limit in which B4 goes to infinity and MB goes to infinity.
You forgot the square, right?
What?
You forgot the square, right?
I forgot the square here. Thank you. Yes. B4 goes to infinity and MB goes to infinity, but with the limit MB squared by B4 held fixed. In this limit, b4 is going to infinity, so we can throw this term away. Mb squared by b4 is held fixed, so that remains. Okay, but there's a particularly interesting value of mb squared by b4, particularly interesting fixed value for this term, which is 0. So let's first focus on that value. If we choose mb squared by b4 to be 0, this term also goes away. The resulting theory is sometimes called the critical scalar theory, or the UN analog of the Wilson-Fisher scalar theory. Okay, it's the UN analog of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, and describes a conformal field theory. Before you couple to the Chern-Simons stuff. Now, this conformal field theory has the property that the operator that replaces phi bar phi in the scalar theory has a larger dimension than phi bar phi. For instance, if we did vector matter in the large n limit, okay, the operator that replaces phi bar phi, basically this sigma operator, has dimension 2 rather than dimension 1. Now, this has interesting consequences, because for a free scalar theory, you had a marginal operator, phi bar phi, the whole thing cube. That was dimension 3. But in this theory, it's exactly like the fermions. The only marginal relevant operator is sigma square, because sigma dimension 2. The only marginal relevant operator is sigma, because sigma is dimension 2. Sigma square is dimension 4. Sigma cube is dimension 6. Gone. So if you can just fine-tune the mass away like we've done, MB3 is equal to 0, you define a conformal field theory. Okay? So this is another construction of scale invariant theories. The Wilson-Fischer bosonic theory coupled to Chern-Simons theories. Okay? These two theories will play a large role in what follows. Okay, great. So, okay, any questions or comments before I proceed? Excellent. Please.
In the case of fermions, if you put this theory on the lattice, it's very focused on the fixed point because the mass term is protected by parity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to fix on. So my question is about the other theory.
Is there a natural way? Well,
is there a zero symmetry that eliminates the linear term in sigma?
No, I don't think so. It's this is basically the ferromagnet.
Yeah.
So you have to fine tune it away. I don't think the symmetry will protect you. But of course, it's easy to do. I mean, for instance, if you were working in dimensional regularization, you just set the mass to 0, and it stays 0. Yeah. Okay, excellent. So now what we got, now these two theories have been studied for in greater detail over the last couple of years. When the fermions and bosons are taken to transform in a particular representation of the gauge group, and in the large end limit. The representation that has been considered and that I will consider in my talk is the vector-like representation, the fundamental representation of UN. Why the fundamental representation? Why this particular idiosyncratic choice? There's an interesting reason for this. The reason is that with this choice, these theories are effectively solvable in the large end limit. And to motivate this observation, I'll remind you that it's famously true that vector large end limits are exactly solvable. You know, Coleman's book on aspects of symmetry in 3 pages will solve this theory, you know, this theory without the gauging. Now, you might protest and say, well, but your theory is not a vector theory, because maybe the matter is a vector theory, like in QCD. But the gauge field's in matrices, and matrices are tough to solve in the large n limit. But remember, these matrices are governed by the Chern-Simons action, and Chern-Simons action is next to nothing, is very near to nothing. Chern-Simons is topological smoke and mirrors. Okay, there are no degrees of freedom for the gauge field. So you might think, and you'd be correct in thinking, that you can actually solve these theories in the large n limit, just like you can solve vector theories in the large n limit. Okay? And that's the reason why there's been some focus on vector theories in the large n limit, of theories of vector matter, fermions and bosons, coupled to Chern-Simons theory. Now, the study of these theories over the last two and a half years has revealed a really interesting surprise. The surprise is as follows. The discovery of the surprise, it's hard to exactly attribute credit, but a large part of the credit goes to Ofer Aharoni and collaborators. Also Maldesin and Zhibodev, and some of it perhaps to our group as well, but it was a bit distributed. Okay, the surprise here was the following. By looking at explicit solutions of these theories, as an experimental observation, you find the following. You find that all results are consistent with the following conjecture. Consistent with the conjecture that there is a duality relating the Chern-Simons theory coupled to this bosonic theory and the Chern-Simons theory coupled to the fermionic theory. Okay? And I want to describe the map of this duality. I want to describe this duality a little bit. Okay. So as I've said, the fermionic, let's first stick to the, by the way, this duality extends to massive deformations of these two theories. But I'll first focus on the massless theories, just for simplicity, the scale method. Okay, the fermionic theory is parameterized by NF and KF, or, right, let's start with KF. The rank and level of the Chern-Simons gauge theory. The bosonic theory is parameterized by NB and KB. Okay, the claim is that the fermionic theory is dual to the bosonic theory if NF is taken to be equal to mod of KB, and KF is minus sine of KB times NB. Okay, up to sines, which are basically an irritant, this is exchanging the level and rank of the Chern-Simons theory. This is a very beautiful thing, because this exchange is known to be a duality of pure Chern-Simons theory. Okay, it's known that pure Chern-Simons theory in three dimensions is invariant under this shift. It's called level rank duality. Okay. Now the claim is that there is reasonable evidence that level rank duality of this topological theory lifts up to level rank duality of physical theories. If on one side you couple the Chern-Simons stuff to Chern-Simons theory to bosons like this, the other side you couple it to fermions. That's the claim. The evidence for this claim is basically threefold. I quickly review it. Firstly, in the large N limit,
I may have destroyed your microphone. Maybe it's just a clip. Will that work?
Sorry about that. Okay. The first thing that's been computed is the following. In the large N limit, the spectrum of single trace operators in this theory have been computed on both sides and been shown to match. This was a bit of a trivial check, because the spectrum turns out in the large N limit not to depend on the gauge coupling. So it matches, but it doesn't feel very convincing. The second thing that's much less trivial is that the three... I did not include monopole operators, but I was talking about these single. So what I'm looking at are operators whose dimension remains fixed in the large N limit. Now, the monopole operators always have dimension of order k, and I'm taking k to infinity in this limit. So this right. So the things that's been checked is for these in this the operators of fixed dimension in the large N. But we're coming to the monopole operators in a minute. Okay. The second thing that's been checked is that for these operators, the three-point functions of these operators have also been computed in a series of very impressive papers with distributed credit, and matched on both sides. They match. And now, Zohar had a concern. He was saying, well, these single-trace operators aren't everything in the story. There are other things like the monopole operators. But there's another calculation that accounts, that includes their effects, and that also matches. And the other calculation is the partition function of these theories. The partition function of these theories on S2 times S1 has been computed on both sides, including with mass deformations. And this has also been found to match at every value of the temperature. Now, every value of the temperature includes temperatures of order n, order square root n, temperatures at order at the order of which the monopole operators will contribute significantly. Okay, so the matching of all these things together makes a pretty convincing case that at least in the large end limit, these theories are dual. Okay? There's an indirect argument, which I won't go through, in a paper we wrote a few months ago, that the matching also continues at finite n, and the indirect argument has to do with I won't go through it now unless somebody's interested. Okay, excellent. So that is, you know, this duality is the third reason to study this theory, these theories, perhaps the best reason of them all. Okay, it's a very interesting duality. It's a generalization of bosonization to three dimensions, and it sounds very interesting. Sounds like it should be studied. Okay, so this ends the introduction and background part of my talk. Any questions or comments before I proceed? Yes? No, if you add adjoint matter, I would suspect that the duality still works. But you see, the evidence for the duality has been very crude. It's exactly like the evidence for duality in supersymmetric theories. Meaning you don't know why they're dual, but you compute on one side, you compute on the other, you find it matches. That's the same kind of thing. We use large N to compute on one side, compute on the other, find it matches. So with that, we can't generalize that crude evidence to your more interesting theory. Okay, I suspect it's true, but.
Shiraz, could you also briefly comment on what pieces of the evidence that you mentioned depends on higher spin symmetry? So what follows in the adjustment?
Okay, so, yeah. Right, so as Zohar points out, as Zohar is alluding to, the matching of three-point functions is largely dictated by higher spin symmetry, in the sense that the papers by Maldesane and Zhubedev demonstrated that the three-point functions were determined up to two unknown parameters just by general considerations in higher spin symmetry. Now, given that it was determined up to two parameters, and given that each theory has two parameters in them, there had to be some map that would make the three-point functions equal. But so that by itself was a weak test. Okay? Except for the fact that the map didn't turn out to be some ugly thing. It turned out to be this beautiful level rank map, which perhaps is some indication. But the thing that's really convincing is that the same map also makes the partition functions equal. As far as I can tell, that is totally, I don't know of any way of constraining that by higher spin symmetry. Okay? These partition functions, you know, include phase transitions, include a high temperature phase that is the analog of the phase in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory dual to black holes. The partition functions with a great deal of structure, and they match exactly between the two sets with this map. Okay, so I would say, as you said, that the evidence would be inconclusive if it was only correlation functions. But with the partition function, seems like a terrible conspiracy if it's untrue. Okay. Line operators. Okay, good. So you see, Wilson loops to leading order get contributions even in pure chern Simons theories. So the question would then be to map the 1 over n corrections. So in pure chern Simons theories, of course, Wilson loops do map to each other under level rank duality. These are the famous tests of pure chern Simons level rank. They also truncate, yes. Though the truncation happens at order k or order n. It's hard to see in the limits we take, the large n limits we take. But yes, there's a whole story there. But you know, any observable that already gets non-trivial contributions from pure Chern-Simons theory is a bit harder to work with because you have to go to next order. Okay, something like the free energy, which effectively gets no contribution on S2, gets no contribution from Chern-Simons theory because there's a single state in Chern-Simons theory, pure Chern-Simons theory, is easier to work with because this stuff is the matter is a leading order effect. But so nobody's really computed the first 1 over n correction to line operators, though it would be interesting.
So similar comments would apply for the S3 partition function.
That's why this has not been matched. Because you have to be very precise. You see, you've got, if your parameter mapping shifts by 1, okay, that will change the pure Chern-Simons part at the same order as the calculation you do. See, it's a much more precise thing to do. Yeah, exactly. Great, other questions, comments? So it's, at least for the first test, it's good to isolate out the part that, you know, gets first non-trivial contribution from the matter. Okay, excellent. Now, So in this talk, what I'm going to do is to try to compute a new set of observables in both these theories. And the new set of observables is different from the observables that have been computed before. These are S matrices in these theories. Now, let me give you 1 minute, 1 minute's motivation on why I look at these observables, and then we'll proceed. One motivation may be as may go as follows. You see, in two-dimensional bosonization, almost everything about bosonization was summarized by this beautiful formula, psi is equal to e to the power I phi. Okay. This formula tells you how to compute correlators of the fermionic fields in terms of correlators of the bosonic field. You might hope that if there's a bosonization going on in three dimensions, we find a formula as powerful as this. But a minute's thought tells you that this is slightly misguided. The reason for this is that psi and phi in our contexts are not gauge invariant. And this formula basically is a formula relating correlators of psi to correlators of e to the pi phi. But the correlators of non-gauge invariant things don't make sense. So you can't hope for something as strong as this. However, there are some correlators of non-gauge invariant quantities that make sense in gauge theories. These are correlators at points that are taken to infinity along lines of free propagation, namely S matrices.
You said that you can't hope to generalize polarization to 3D because of gauge invariant?
Because of gauge invariant. Because this quantity is not a gauge invariant quantity.
Yeah, but that did not stop Coleman to bosonize QED into dimensions.
So bosonization is true, okay? But there cannot be a formula relating psi to phi except in a particular gauge.
Yeah, that's right. But this did not stop Coleman from solving the Schrödinger model in two dimensions using bosonization, even though psi was gauge invariant.
Okay. Actually, I'm not even familiar with that. So, but did he have a formula like this?
No, because the gauge field couples to the current.
So you find bosonization for the currents then. Exactly. So this has already been done, right? Because the currents in our theory, the analog of the currents, are the highest spin currents, and we know how they map to each other. But you may not be completely satisfied with that. You may want something more like this. You may want to see. So I'm not saying that bosonization is not true. I'm saying that a formula expressing the fermion in terms of the boson doesn't make sense because it's not gauge invariant. That's also true in QED, but not for this, for the free boson, free fermion. Okay, yeah. But what I want to say is that there is a formula that has this flavor. And that is that if you take these correlators and take them to infinity along the right paths, these are, by the LSZ formula, S matrices. And S matrices are supposed to be well-defined and sensible, even if you're not scattering gauge invariant quantities. For instance, there's been a huge amount of work for scattering of S matrices of gluons in N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. Okay? So you might, as an attempt to find a bosonization formula that is better than bosonization for the currents, you might want to try to relate S matrices on the two sides. Okay? So that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to compute the S matrices on both sides and see how they relate to each other. That's what I'm going to try to do in this talk. Okay, now, before I actually start the calculation, let me start with some kinematics. Okay, in my theories, I'm going to use some names. Every object that transforms in the fundamental of the gauge group, I'll call a particle. Every object that transforms in the anti-fundamental, I'll call an antiparticle. And I will be interested in studying particle-particle scattering. And also particle antiparticle scattering. Where P stands for a particle, it's got a fundamental index, A stands for an antiparticle, it's got an antiparticle. Okay. Now, let's look at particle-particle scattering. I could also look at antiparticle-antiparticle scattering, but that's trivially related to particle-particle. I won't separately consider it. Okay, now let's look at particle-particle scattering first. It looks like the data of this scattering process has 4 gauge indices as well as 4 momenta. But the dependence of the scattering process on the gauge indices is largely fixed by group theory. Okay, so you could have a structure in which you have I and K with a delta function equating I and K and a delta function equating J and M, or the reverse, I and M and J and K. So basically, there are two independent functions of momenta that you have to compute, the coefficients of each of these structures. Now you could ask, why was the number 2? And there is a group theoretic, it will be useful to us later on, so let me say it, a group theoretic way of understanding why this is 2. It's simply that in the product of two fundamentals, there are two irreducible representations. Okay, that's this plus this. Okay? And one way of writing the S matrix is to write the projector in IJ space onto either of these representations, then identity, so just moves on identically to the KM space, and write the S matrix behind each of these two structures. Okay, so that's this guy would be the linear combination of the two guys I mentioned before, delta IK, delta JM, plus delta IM, delta JK. And this guy would be with a minus. Similarly, in particle-antiparticle scattering, there are two independent structures because fundamental and anti-fundamental can combine either into the singlet or the adjunct. Okay, so our goal is to compute these four S matrices, these four functions of momenta, then multiply each of these four non-distinct index structures. Okay, before turning to an actual calculation, I want to review what is already known about these S matrices in general. In the literature. Nobody studied this quantum field theoretic problem before, as far as I'm aware. But there is a particular limit of this problem that has been studied by many people. This limit is the non-relativistic limit. So suppose you do scattering. So I should have emphasized that, in general, I will be studying these theories after I deform each side with a mass. Okay? This makes actually the S matrix very clean observable, because there are no massless particles at all in matter. Matter is massive, and the gluons are massless, but there are no gluons. There are no massless particles. Okay? So no multi-gluon infrared divergences that make life so complicated in other scattering processes. Okay. Now, the limit that is very easy is when the energy, S, a square root of S, is taken to tend to 2 times the mass. Approaching 2 times the mass from above. This is the non-relativistic limit. Most of the energy is in the mass. Everything else is small. Okay. In the non-relativistic limit, this scattering amplitude has been studied by many people in great detail in the early 1990s and late 1980s. I'm following the presentation by Jack Yu and collaborators. Okay. Jack Yu and collaborators, using various techniques, quite simple techniques, you see, scattering for them is solving a Schrodinger equation. They solve the Schrodinger equation by going to center of mass coordinates and relative coordinates, like we normally go. So it becomes like a one-particle Schrodinger equation. What's really interesting is that what they're able to show is that this effect of one-particle Schrodinger equation is exactly the Schrodinger equation of a particle scattering of a magnetic flux tube. The reason for that, actually, this is a very simple reason for that. The Chern-Simons equation of motion is k times f is equal to j. So if you've got a particle which carries j, it traps f. The second particle scattering off it scatters basically off the flux tube that it traps. Okay? So what they are able to show is the following. They are able to show that scattering, suppose you take two non-relativistic particles in representations R1 and R2. As we've explained, you have many different scattering functions depending on the number of representations that appear in the Clebsch-Gordan product of R1 and R2. Suppose Rm is a representation that appears in the Clebsch-Gordan product of R1 and R2. Then the scattering matrix of R1 plus R2 going to R1 plus R2 in the Rm channel is given by the Aharonov-Bohm scattering problem of a particle of unit charge scattering off a flux tube, where the magnitude of the flux tube depends on what Rm is, and is given by the simple formula. It's the quadratic Casimir of R1 plus the quadratic Casimir of R2 minus the quadratic Casimir of Rm divided by k.
That kind of means this computation could have been done in George-Simon's theory.
Right.
So it doesn't test something new.
So far, But we're going to go beyond this non-relativistic limit, in which it'll be much, much less trivial. Yeah, that's right. That's right. As Zohar points out, you know, people who are familiar with the study of pure Chern-Simons theory might recognize this. C2R by K is the dimension for the primary for the primary Wessomino-Witten operator in representation R. So this formula is a formula for the monodromy, basically. A monodromy of a four-point function of R1, R2 with R1, R2 in the channel, in the conformal block labeled by Rn. Okay. But, right. So this is going to be very simple, but still will be very important, physically very important, as we'll see. Now you see, so I said that what you get is Arnold Bohm scattering with this value of the flux. So what was the formula of Arnold Bohm scattering? So I've written this down for you. The S matrix here, now I've written down a part that people don't normally write, just to emphasize something important. The S matrix is always identity plus scattering. Okay? And Arnold Bohm, their calculation, when corrected, actually they made a couple of mistakes. But when corrected, their S matrix takes the following form. Their S matrix takes the form, takes the following very interesting form. So I'm looking at the S matrix in as a function of scattering angle. Okay? Firstly, there is a part proportional to cot theta by 2. This is a little reminiscent of Rutherford scattering. Okay, something that blows up at small angle. Okay, great. Next, there's a part proportional to constant. It's independent of the angle. But notice that it's got a sign of the flux. So it's non-analytic as a function of flux at flux equals 0. We'll come back to this in a moment. The thing that's really important at this point is that there's also a piece proportional to delta of theta, a part that is localized at forward scattering. Okay? Now, this is a very strange piece. It's a very strange term. It's a very strange term and begs for an interpretation. Okay? There's actually, however, a very simple interpretation of this term, physical interpretation for this term, and let me give it to you. Suppose we've got a magnetic flux tube here, and we've got a little wave packet, and it's going a scattering of this flux tube. Okay? The non-trivial part of scattering, all of this, has to do with, you know, stuff going out. But the part that was one, that was allegedly one, is just this, which is most of the scattering, is just the wave packet going through the magnetic tube unaffected. However, when we've got this flux tube, nothing is really unaffected. Because you see, about half of this wave packet goes from above and picks up the phase e to the power I pi nu. Since it's half, I'll divide by 2. The other half goes from below and picks up the phase e to the power minus I pi nu. So what, if what goes in is 1, what comes out is the sum of e to the power I pi nu plus e to the power minus I pi nu divided by 2, which is cos pi nu. So you see, in this problem, if you've been thinking right, you should not have said scattering is 1 plus stuff. You should have said scattering is instead cos pi nu plus stuff. But if you didn't realize that, what you would do is they say scattering is 1 plus stuff, and then that stuff will include cos pi nu minus 1 times 1 to compensate for that. And that's exactly how it works. Okay? Now this physical explanation for this term is so simple that I'm going to assume that this feature, this contribution proportional to 1, is true even away from the non-relativistic limit. It's an exact feature of the scattering amplitude. And you will see where that comes in as we move on. Okay? Great. So now let me move on. Now I'm actually going to move on to the actual calculation we did. Okay, so what I want to do is compute these four S matrices. I know what they look like in the non-relativistic limit. There's one more thing I have to say. The other thing I have to say is that I gave you this abstract formula, but of course in our situation, R1 and R2 are either the fundamental or the anti-fundamental. So I should tell you what this objective amounts to. In the large N limit, the quadratic Casimir for the fundamental and anti-fundamental is N by 2, and the quadratic Casimir for the adjoint or either of those representations is n. So if you look at this, you see that for both channels in particle-particle scattering, we get n by 2 plus n by 2 minus n, which is 0 in the large n limit. Okay, and for the particle-antiparticle scattering in the adjoint channel, once again, you get n by 2 plus n by 2 minus n. So three of the four channels have trivial Arnold-Bohm phase in the large n limit. But the fourth channel, namely the scattering in the singlet channel, has n by 2 plus n by 2 minus 0. So scattering in the singlet channel has nu m, this effect of flux, equals lambda. Okay, by the way, this, so what have we concluded? We've concluded that scattering is effectively anionic in one of the four exchange channels. By the way, this observation gives you a very simple explanation for this, a very simple argument for this duality map. Okay.
Isn't that the argument of Polyakov from 84 or 83? So Polyakov suggested that there was the bosonization is 3D and showed that the boson in the presence of time uncertainty is any other statistic.
Yeah, it's that argument. But was he working with the U1 theory?
I believe so.
Yes. So it's that argument in a non-abelian context made in a concrete non-abelian context. Yes. Okay. And the argument, as Zohar has seen, is simply that, you see, this non-abelian statistics is the following. When you take two particles and exchange them, you pick up a phase. If you had pure bosons, the phase would be 0. If you had pure fermions, the phase would be pi. Okay? Now, with bosons, in the singlet channel with this thing, you pick up the phase pi lambda. With fermions, you pick up the phase pi minus pi fermionic lambda. Equating the two gives you a relationship between lambda fermion and lambda boson, which agrees with what comes out of here. Okay? So as Zohar said, it's basically the statement that in this channel, you're scattering anions. And you have to get to the same anion, whether you start from the bosonic description or start from the fermionic description. Okay? So that's one way of understanding why you should have expected this duality. Okay, great. Now, I've spent a lot of time on generalities. Let me move to my calculation. Okay. In order to compute this S matrix, what we did is very simple. What we did is some Feynman diagrams. Okay, following our original paper on the subject, we work in a light cone gauge. Okay, we work in the gauge A minus equals 0. A minus equals 0. Why is this particularly simple? This is particularly simple because in Chern-Simons theory, gauge boson interactions are of the form A1, A2, A3. So if you set any component of the gauge boson to 0, the cubic term vanishes. Okay? This is, of course, part of the reason that Chern-Simons is only fakely interacting theory. Okay. So in this gauge, all Feynman diagrams become very simple. So in order to study scattering, first we had to study propagation. So I'm looking at the fermionic theory. It's a bit more complicated than the bosonic theory. In the large n limit, you have to sum graphs like this for the propagator. This, thankfully, we'd done in our first paper on the subject 2 years ago. You write down a Schwinger-Dyson equation, solve for it. You can do it. You get a formula for the exact propagator. That's not good enough for scattering. You also have to scatter. For scattering in the large n limit, the only graphs that contribute are these. Ladder graphs. Okay, where every one of these propagators is an exact propagator. But we don't have to worry about that since we already know what the exact propagators are. Okay, now this is summed. This, you can sum all these ladder graphs by the following maneuver. Let this denote the exact scattering amplitude. This is equal to the tree-level scattering amplitude plus okay, this Schwinger-Dyson equation sums all these ladder graphs. Well, this is the exact guy. So you write down an integral equation, putting this diagrammatic equation into formulas, and you try to solve it. Now, following over Aharoni and collaborators, we were able to solve these equations, but only in a particular kinematical regime. And that's going to be important, so I have to explain. So let me label the momenta on these graphs by P plus Q and P, K plus Q, and K. This labeling already operates momentum. Now, notice that, so suppose I have P plus Q and P, K plus Q and K. Notice that if you write down the momentum in any intermediate channel here, it'll be of the form P prime plus Q and P prime. What's important is that the Q here is a conserved quantity through these graphs, just the momentum flowing through the graphs. So it's consistent to study these equations at particular values of Q. Different values of Q don't mix. Okay? And we were able to solve these off-shell four-point correlators only when Q plus was equal to Q minus was equal to zero. Aharoni and collaborators observed that the integral equation simplifies greatly in this limit. Now, it's important to ask what that means physically. What have we given up by the technical requirement of knowing the answer for the four-point function only at Q plus equals Q minus equals zero? You see, when Q plus is equal to Q, we can solve for the whole off-shell correlator. To get the S matrix, we have to go on-shell. So the question is, does Q plus equals Q minus equals zero interfere with our ability to go on-shell in the various channels of interest? Suppose we're looking at scattering, but these two guys are the initial particles and these two are the final particles. Then if Q is the center of mass momentum. And if Q plus equals Q minus equals zero, that means Q is purely a spatial vector. This cannot be consistently put on shell. So in this, where these two are initial and these two are final, we cannot, this a technical limitation forbids us from computing this S matrix. And this turns out, it turns out that we're, for that reason, unable to directly compute the S matrix in a singular channel. However, in the, if, for instance, these two were initial and these two were final, it's easy to verify that Q is the momentum transfer in this process. Now, momentum transfer in the scattering of two equal mass particles is always space-like. So by a choice of Lorentz frame, you can always set Q plus equals Q minus equals zero on shell. So, and this turns out to be true in all other three channels. So in the three other channels, the technical restriction that forces us to set Q plus equals Q minus equals zero just tells us that we're looking at scattering in a particular choice of Lorentz frame. Okay, so we can compute it there, covariantize the answer, we don't lose any information. So by this maneuver, we are able to find exact formulas for the S matrices as a function of the coupling constant in three out of the four channels by direct calculation. Okay? Now, let me just show you what the answers. Okay, I've written down the answer in one of the channels of particle-particle scattering. Okay, it's actually the channel in which I was equal to M and J was equal to K. It was not one of these linear combinations just because that takes twice as much writing. Okay, this has the identity piece plus the scattering piece. The scattering piece has this cot theta by 2 term, which is very simple. Actually, this part comes just from tree level. The really interesting thing is the part that is, it's just some function of t, the momentum transfer. And this function of t takes the following form. I've given you the answer for the boson equation. Okay, this function turns out to be the following. Now, what can we say about this answer? Firstly, you can take, you see that this answer has Q is the momentum transfer here. It's to some fractional power. So this answer is an interesting answer in the sense that it has non-trivial analytic structure. Okay? At all values of lambda except lambda equals 1. We'll come to that. See, now let's first take the limit lambda goes to 0. In the limit lambda goes to 0, here you can just, in the numerator here, you can just set lambda to 0. But because there's lambda here, and the denominator goes to 0 as lambda goes to 0, you have to take this limit a bit carefully. And you pick up a log term from expanding this to the power lambda. And then you can compare this answer to the, so if lambda goes to zero, this should just be the scattering amplitude for phi to the four, large n phi to the four theory, which is well known. And of course, this agrees. But I wanted to emphasize that this answer had non-trivial analytic structure at all values of lambda, including lambda equals zero. But at lambda equals one, something interesting happens. The interesting thing that happens is that now at lambda equals one, you no longer have a cut from here. It's just some rational function. And if you work this out, at lambda equals one, this J q just evaluates to minus 8 pi times Cb. Cb is the mass of the boson, pole mass of the boson. Okay? So you just get minus 8 pi times Cb. Now, lambda equals 1 under the duality map I showed you when you rewrite in terms of lambda, boson to fermion, was lambda goes to 1 minus lambda. So lambda equals 1 was lambda equals 0 for the fermions. Okay? So it should have been that at lambda equals 0, 1, you got a very simple answer, because that should just be tree-level scattering for the fermions. And indeed, when you calculate the tree-level scattering amplitude for the fermions, you get a precise match with this answer. But you can do better. You can compute the whole answer for the fermions at all values of lambda f and match with this answer. And, I should have said that the simplification to 8 pi Cb only happens if you first take b4 to infinity. That was the limit in which the theory was supposed to have been dual to the fermions. Okay? So anyway, in the limit that you take b4 to infinity, you look at this answer, you do the calculation on the fermionic side, you make the parameter map, and these two answers agree exactly. Okay, good. Now what about the other channels? When you work it out in the other channel, the channel where you put the delta function such as I is k and j is m, something very similar happens, except that the two sides differ by a minus sign. Okay? Now, we found that very strange for when that first happened, but later made peace with it, because actually that's what you should have expected. You see, as I've tried to explain, the actual physical quantities should be thought of as the coefficients behind these group theory factors, these group theory projectors. And the S matrices behind the symmetric guy are the sum of this direct and exchange process, whereas the S matrix behind the antisymmetric is the difference of the direct and exchange process. Now, if, let's say, the exchange process differs by a minus sign, what happens is that you flip these two. So what we find just by calculation is that S bosonic in this channel is equal to S fermionic in this channel. And S bosonic in this channel is equal to S fermionic in this channel. Now you could ask, is this something one should have expected? And the answer is yes. Because as Jaume asked at some point in the talk, it's well known how Wilson loops, just in pure Chern-Simons theory, it's well known how Wilson loops transform under level rank duality. And the transformation involves a flip of representations. Okay? Wilson loop in a particular representation R on one side of the dual is a Wilson loop in a representation that's sometimes called R transpose on the other side of the dual. And it is easy to check that these two representations are linked to each other by this transposition. Okay? So we already knew that under level rank duality, these two representations should be exchanged. So it's not unnatural that the S matrices and these two representations should be exchanged. This leads us to conjecture that, in general, the S matrix in some representation R will always map to the S matrix in some representation in the level rank dual transpose representation. Okay. There's also a more physical way of saying this. Let me just say the physical way in a minute. It goes this way. Suppose you've got two particles, and they're symmetric in their bosonic labels. In their momentum labels. If they're bosons, they better be symmetric also in the color labels to meet the requirements of Bose statistics. But if they're fermions, they better then be anti-symmetric in their color labels to meet the requirements of Fermi statistics. And that's basically what's going on here. If you're going to have duality between bosons and fermions, something like this must happen. Okay, great. The adjoint channel turns out to be the most boring. The answers just match between the two sides with no interesting lessons as far as we were able to see. So good. So we've done all the three channels where we could do the explicit calculations. We've done the calculations. They match. Okay. But that's not satisfying because there's a fourth channel. And the fourth channel is by far the most interesting channel. It's the singular channel. And this was the channel that in the non-relativistic limit was non-trivial. All the others were trivial in the non-relativistic. So the fourth channel is the relativistic field theory generalization of Aronoff Bohm scattering. And we want to know the answer for it. Now, some of you are probably thinking, what's the big deal? Certainly, this is what we thought at the beginning of the project. If you know the answer in any two channels, you can find the other two by crossing symmetry. Okay. So in a usual quantum field theory, if you know particle-particle scattering, particle-antiparticle scattering is determined from that by crossing symmetry. Okay. So it's natural then to try to guess the answer in the singular channel just using crossing symmetry. And if you were dealing with the usual quantum, if things were working as usual, you would just get the answer. So we tried that. We applied the formulas of crossing symmetry to get a conjecture for the answer in the S channel, though we can't directly compute it. Okay? And this is what the conjecture amounts to. It amounts to that S is equal to identity plus this T trial. Unfortunately, this conjecture fails every consistency check. It doesn't have the right non-relativistic limit. It is not consistent with unitarity. Let me give you a word about unitarity. Unitarity in a usual quantum field theory is a constrains two particle scattering matrices in terms of multiparticle scattering matrices. Because you know the cuts for unitarity could involve unitarity cuts could involve two particles coming in, let's say, four going in the middle. Okay, so in order to understand how the cuts for two particle scattering, you would in general need to know 2 to 4 scattering or 2 to 6 scattering and so on. But in our theory, that's not true. In our theory, in the large n limit, the contribution due to intermediate 2 to 4 scattering, for instance, is down because this diagram has an additional index loop compared to the diagram without it. It's 1 over n suppressed. You can easily convince yourself. So in our theory, unitarity is a sharp constraint, a sharp closed constraint on 2-2-2 scattering. Okay. It's a nonlinear equation that constrains 2-2-2 scattering. Turns out that the constraint is trivial for the three channels where you can do the calculation. Basically because the scattering amplitudes in these three channels are all order 1 by n. The right-hand side of unitarity is 1 by n squared because it's S dagger S. And so it just tells you that the amplitude is real, which is easily verified. However, in the singlet channel, the projector onto the singlet is delta ij delta k m divided by n. And this is the S matrix that you want to compute. This division by n is part of the projector. This is one way of saying it. There are many ways of saying it. But it turns out that this S obeys a non-trivial constraint from unitarity. It's really S plus S dagger is equal to SS dagger. Okay? So in the singlet channel, there is a non-trivial, non-linear equation that the S matrix has to obey from unitarity, and this answer does not obey it. Okay. However, it's very easy with a little fooling around, we checked that the following was true. That if we took T trial and multiplied it by into sine pi lambda by pi lambda, then everything works. Okay? The non-relativist limit works out, right? And much more non-trivially, the unitarity equation also works. I emphasize that this non-linear equation is very hard to work just by coincidence. Always be a strict lambda. Yeah. I just want to show you how the non-relativistic limit works. You see, this looks like a pretty complicated answer, but it has to reduce in that Okay, if I can get the boards right, I might show you what it has to reduce to. But look what happens in the non-relativistic limit to this answer. We've got this strange factor, half plus cb by square root s divided by half minus cb by square root s to the power lambda b. Now, in the non-relativistic limit, square root s approaches 2 times cb. So the denominator of this term approaches 0. So this term blows up. But the term to the power lambda either is infinity or 0, depending on whether lambda is positive or negative. So if lambda is positive, this term's infinity. These you can forget, and this just becomes minus 1. But if lambda is negative, this you can forget. These two cancel each other, so it becomes plus 1. So this whole bracket in the non-relativistic limit becomes minus sgn of lambda. Minus the sine of lambda. Okay? Which is exactly what we had in this Arnold-Bohm formula. Remember, we are identifying lambda with nu. Okay? And this is quite interesting because, you know, you might have thought that since we're doing perturbation theory, we could never recover something non-analytic in lambda. And indeed, at generic values of coupling, it's not non-analytic. But in the non-relativistic limit, we recover the non-analyticity of the Arnold-Bohm scattering. Okay, excellent. So, what do we have here? We have that, I should have said, in addition to this T trial, we also have to include this piece by hand, this delta function piece. This piece is a non-analytic contribution to the S matrix. It can never come from an analytic continuation. So we're including this piece by hand, and then multiplying what you get from crossing symmetry by sine pi lambda by pi lambda. And this meets every consistency check. The last consistency check it meets, by the way, is that I've said what happens with the bosons. But if you do it on the fermionic side, you have all the same troubles. Once again, if you multiply the fermionic answer by sine pi lambda fermion by pi lambda fermion, it meets all consistency checks. And these two answers map to each other under duality. These two conjectured answers map to each other under duality. Okay? So now this really sounds like the right answer. It sounds, so we are forced to conjecture, that the usual relations of crossing symmetry are modified in these theories. And they're modified in this strange way. So in the last 2 minutes, I'm sorry I've gone over time, but last 2-3 minutes of this talk, I'm going to give you a very heuristic.
One quick question, maybe.
Yes.
Can you use these to learn something about the spectrum of bound states?
Ah, yes, you can. It's a very interesting question. It turns out that this J here sometimes has poles. Okay. So I don't remember the numbers here. But there is a particular critical value of B4. When B4 is less than some B4 crit, there are first developed poles in this. The pole, when it develops, is a pole on threshold. Its mass is twice the mass of them. So when it develops near that, you should be able to study it using a Schrodinger equation, because it's effectively a non-relativistic problem. We haven't done that, but it should be possible. Then as B4 goes further and further, smaller and smaller, actually, into the negatives, the mass of this bound state goes smaller and smaller until it hits 0. And then it becomes imaginary, signaling an instability of the theory. Now, when B4 is negative, at least sufficiently negative, you expect the theory to be unstable, because it's fighters of our theory with a negative potential. Okay? So you predict exactly one bound state in the Ziegler channel. You predict its mass. It would be great to confirm it from some other way. Right. Now, so the last 2-3 minutes, I'm just going to give you a possible way of thinking. This is very heuristic, okay? For why you might have expected something like this additional factor in crossing symmetry. Okay. This way of thinking uses the following. Look, you could ask, where does crossing symmetry come from? Why do scattering amplitudes have crossing symmetry? One way of trying to understand this is by regarding a scattering amplitude as a limit of a correlator, and using the analyticity properties and channel duality properties of the correlator to motivate analyticity properties for S matrices. And at least heuristically, this sort of works, except that it can't work in our case, because as I've emphasized, the correlator does not exist, because we're looking at correlators as something gauge non-invariant. It's only the S matrix that exists. So if we want to take this attitude, we have to do something a little more clever. So the kind of thing that you could try to look at is something like this. Put insertions of a fundamental and anti-fundamental, anti-fundamental and fundamental, and connect it by large Wilson lines outside to make it nice and gauge invariant. and use the nice analyticity properties of this object to try to argue for crossing symmetry. Perhaps you could do this. No, nobody's tried to do this in detail. By the way, you could have connected the Wilson lines in two ways. You could have connected F with A here or F with A here. Those are the two channels of scattering. Okay. However, you see, when you do this at zero coupling, all that the Wilson line is doing is contracting indices. So this is exactly what you want to do. You focus on a particular channel of scattering. But in non-zero coupling, you may be spoiling what you want to compute. Now let's try to make a very rough heuristic argument for how what you want to compute is being contaminated. This argument is motivated by Witten's paper, Jones polynomials, John Simon's theory, as you will see. You see, this path integral in radial quantization can be thought of as a scalar product. A scalar product between a state formed by the path integral inside and a state formed from the path integral outside. Now, the scalar product is in a Hilbert space that has matter part and a gauge field part. The matter part of the scalar product is the S matrix you want. The gauge field part of the scalar product comes along for the ride. Now, the gauge field part of the scalar product happens, as Witten explains, in an interesting Hilbert space. The Hilbert space of conformal blocks of a fundamental and two fundamentals and two anti-fundamentals on S2. This is a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay. And has non-trivial structure. Okay? So what I want to do is to estimate the pure gauge field contribution to the scalar product in each of the two scattering channels. Now, in the scattering channel where these two are initial and these two are final, the singlet scattering channel, particles, these Wilson loops here you put were of your observable, you put it in by hand. But they get continued by particle paths, physical particle paths that go like this. And so effectively, this inner product is in the gauge field sector, is the expectation value of a single Wilson loop on S3, which is of circular topology. Okay? So this quantity, the thing that you thought would be the S matrix in the singlet channel, is actually Wilson loop, okay, let's say, expectation value of Wilson loop on S3 times the matter S matrix. On the other hand, when you look at the other channel, you get a closing like this. Okay? So in the other channel, it's the expectation value of two Wilson loops times particle-particle. Now, of course, luckily, Witten and many people after him have computed all these expectation values of Wilson loops. So you can just look these up. And this guy turns out to be sine pi lambda by pi lambda, whereas this guy turns out to be sine pi lambda by pi lambda square. Up to factors of n that I'm not keeping track of because they all work out. So what we conclude then is that the nice analyticity properties of this guy with the Wilson lines should imply that this times S singlet analytically continues to this times S particle-particle. Canceling one factor of this, you conclude that you should expect analytic continuation between S singlet and the expectation value of a single circular Wilson loop, which is sine pi lambda by pi lambda, exactly the factor we find, times S particle particle. But that's exactly what we find.
Basically, I think what you're trying to say is that there is topological field theory.
Yes.
Below the mass scale of the fermion.
Yes.
And when you do this thing like space-time,
yes,
you pick up
some factor from this topological field theory. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say I've estimated what that factor is. Okay? And this precisely accounts for that mismatch. So, if this is, now, I tried this argument on Witten, okay, and he had an interesting response. He said, it's a very interesting argument, and he's come and talked to me about it many times, so I think he thinks it's interesting, but I cannot guarantee that it's correct. And I think it's a fair assessment. I mean, this is a hope for an argument rather than an argument. Maybe we can make it precise. However, you know, the fact that the answer seems to be this, from other points of view, makes me think that it is correct. Okay, so that's it. So that's it, it's the end of my talk. So the punchline is that we've computed the S matrix in these two theories, both for the bosons as well as for the fermions. We have explicit answers. You might think they're pretty complicated explicit answers, but anyone who thinks that hasn't seen scattering amplitudes in N equals 4 Yang-Mills. The explicit answers, they map to each other and duality. They've taught us how the map goes. It goes when you map exchange representations under level rank duality. But the real surprise for me is that there are modified crossing symmetry rules if our conjecture is correct. If our conjecture is correct, this should be a general feature of all Chern-Simons matter theories, including ABJM theory. And there's an interesting fact, by the way, which is not very well advertised in these papers, but it seems to me to be a fact. If you look at ABJM, just 1 minute more, there's an apparent puzzle in two-loop scattering in ABJM theory. Okay, the apparent puzzle is a very simple one, so I'll just tell you about it. Maybe somebody can educate me on why it's not a puzzle, but it seems to me to be a puzzle. The puzzle is this. When you do four-particle scattering in ABJM theory, any paper you look up tells you that at one loop, four-particle scattering is zero. But at two loops, they get an interesting answer with non-trivial cuts. Now, the puzzle seems to be the following, that how do you saturate these cuts? You see, suppose you want to saturate a two-loop cut, you can imagine doing it in two ways. You can imagine doing it by tree-level five-point, gluing it up. But these tree-level 5 points don't exist in ABJM theory. So that can't be where it comes from, just from gauge invariance. Or you could imagine doing it from one-loop 4 point with tree-level 4 point. But we've just been told that this is zero. So it seems like there's no candidate to saturate these cuts. And actually, all the papers who talk about this mention this, but they don't make a big deal of it. It doesn't worry them very much somehow. But it seems to me that there's a unitarity puzzle in ABJM theory, very similar to the kind of puzzle that you would get if you just did a naive and very similar to the kind of puzzles we got at intermediate stages of our calculations when we did not dare to imagine that crossing symmetry was modified. So I think there is a chance that these ideas have a role to play in understanding scattering in the supersymmetric theories as well, though I know very little about that at the moment. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Okay, if you take my way of thinking seriously, that would have to come from contact terms. Okay, which is a much more subtle issue than understanding insertions of the operators. So hopefully yes, but then you'd have to look at what happens to operators if they come together. In particular, the contact terms. You see that, right? Because that's these two guys coming together. So perhaps yes, but that's much more subtle. It's a good question.